BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. And here's round one. For 2 marks, I want to know the meaning of the following words. Dillis Powell, what's the meaning of longanimity?
Anima means mind, and long means long. Like equanimity, which means being equal-minded, sort of quiet-minded, long-minded, forbearing.
Well done, Dillis. Longanimity, which is a fairly rare word, and I'm glad Dillis has got it right. It means being terribly long-suffering, which not many of us are, or terribly forbearing. Now, Dennis Norden, what is a tutu? T-U, T-U.
It's, in French, it's W. But it's that sort of frilly miniskirt that's worn by ballet dancers in the Greek army.
Well done, Dennis. It's a sort of white carnation upside down, and that's it, ballet dancer's skirt. Anne Scott James, what is a grilse? G-R-I-L-S-E.
Oh, it's a lovely thing. The silver skin and cucumber fingers, and it's a young salmon. It's just about the best dish of any description that one can eat.
Well done, 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is a growlery?
Growlery?
Mm.
It's a domestic.
It's not a bad idea to think of the original derivation of the word boudoir.
Ah, it's a sort of den.
Yes.
It's a snuggery where you don't snug but growl. It's a place of refuge for the man of the house to go and go, women,
Thanks, absolutely dead right. A growlery, at any rate in Victorian times, was a private room or den where you went and growled off about the world or your family or anything else, encouraged enough boudoir, which has become a quite sort of delicate term. Boudoir for women was literally a place where you sulked in. So that's the female equivalent of growlery. 2 marks. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then I want the 2 women members of the teams to study those quotations particularly, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dennis Powell and Frank Miller, your quotation is, "Beware the awful avalanche." And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, yours is, "Parting is such sweet sorrow." And at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Round two is a round of differences, and this round, members of the team are given 2 very similar-sounding words, and for 2 marks, they'll be asked to distinguish between the words, the definition of the 2 words. Dillis Powell, the difference between sympathy and empathy.
Sympathy is feeling something with somebody.
Yes.
And empathy is feeling something in something.
Could you expand on the second one? The first one is quite good enough.
Could you expand?
Yes. Empathy. You feel something in yourself. Really?
Yeah, you're going the wrong way around.
Am I? Outside yourself.
Sorry, no.
Honest, it's in yourself.
The journey is in the wrong direction.
You feel a cord in somebody else.
To which you respond.
Yes.
Yes.
I'll give one of my very rare 1¾ marks. Sympathy means being simultaneously affected with the same feeling of another person or thing, that is really fellow feeling, or to be in agreement with somebody else's opinion. And empathy is something which is goes a good deal further. The ability or power to project your personality into and so fully to comprehend the object that you're contemplating. It's much fuller and more powerful understanding and appreciation than sympathy is. Anyway, you got very near it once we got it. Dennis Norton, the difference between ineffectual and ineffective.
Spelt differently. I always used to avoid these distinguish between questions in exams. And I always remember somebody telling me about a reporter who was reporting a case, and he sent in his copy which said, "She tripped up and fell prostitute upon the floor." The editor sent it back to him and said, "You must learn to distinguish between a fallen woman and one who has merely lost her balance." So I'm not going to get very far. Ineffective.
And yeah. Ineffectual.
Ineffectual. Well, I would say that somebody who's ineffective is unable to cope with a given situation.
Yes.
Where somebody who's ineffectual is habitually unable to cope with any situation.
Yes, I'll give you 2 marks for that.
Oh,
well done.
Well, yep.
Defining it in slightly different terms, ineffectual means without effect, weak or tame in effect, useless in general terms. That's where Dennis is absolutely right. Ineffective means not producing the desired effect, that is, inefficient in a particular thing, which a person might be. Well done, 2 marks. And Scott James, the difference between jurist and juror. J-U-R-O-R, not the mountains.
Well, I suppose a jurist is somebody who's a theoretician, who is theoretically expert in the law.
Yes.
And a juror is somebody who's sitting on a jury.
Yes, good enough. 2 marks. Jurist is one versed in law, can be a legal writer, can be a student of law. I think in the United States he can be a lawyer. But a juror is a member of the jury. It simply means one who has taken an oath, just as the non-jurors in the 17th century were those who refused the oath of allegiance to William and Mary. 2 marks. Frank Muir, the difference between spitchcock and spatchcock.
The difference is that I know what one is and I don't know what the other one is. A spatchcock is a very quick meal involving a hen.
Yes.
What a spitchcock is. Doesn't do with beer.
No, I'd swim rather.
Just a boat adventure.
Ah.
What?
Swim rather than drink.
It's a fish.
Yes. A spitchcock is an eel split and broiled, or preparing an eel in that way, preparing its spitchcock. Frank was right. The spatchcock is a fowl killed and cooked in a hurry and probably eaten in a hurry too. And it's probably short for dispatch cock. 1.5. We now go a bit more serious and have a round of Thomas Hardy characters. What I'm going to do is to give the names of the characters, and for 2 marks, I want the name of the book in which he or she appears. Lewis Powell, Gabriel Oak.
He's in Far From the Madding Crowd.
Remember what he was and did.
He was the rather nice chap. He was a kind of farmer who had a great bit of bad luck with his sheep, who all were driven over a precipice or something by a dog,
mm-hmm.
and he was in love with a heroine, and I think, did he get her in the end? I can't remember.
Yes, he did. 2 marks. Gabriel Oak, in Far From Madding Crowd, was a small farmer, rather like Bo Peep. He lost his sheep, and became bailiff to Bathsheba Everdeen, and he married her in the end as her second husband after many enormously difficult intervening episodes. Dennis Norton, Jude Fawley.
I can only, at a guess, say it's Jude the Obscure, which I never read.
You're dead right. You get your 2 marks at once. The hero, if that's it, of Jude the Obscure. Hans Scott James, Angel Clare.
Oh, he's the young man in the Tess of the D'Urbervilles, who marries Tess.
What happened?
Well, she murdered him. Was hanged.
No, you've telescoped about 15 chapters and got it wrong.
What happened? Well, he went off and left her when he found she was unchaste.
That's right.
And she then trudged off to see his father. And when she got there, she changed her mind, trudged all the way back again. Can you remember what happened after that?
I never
Such
read it.
Such a sad book.
Oh, I'm still waiting for the film, yeah.
One and a half, I think. Angel Clare was a son of a clergyman. He married Tess, and he abandoned her at once on their wedding night because she then foolishly confessed that she'd had an affair with Alec D'Urberville and everything else that went wrong in that very wrong novel, as it were, started from that point. One and a half. Frank Muir, Diggory Venn.
The Venn of Castlebridge. Well, I don't know where it goes.
Wrong novel. Let's start again.
Jack, it seems to me we've sat and talked like this before. We looked at each other in the same way then. And I can't remember where or when.
I think you're...
Under the greenwood tree.
No, no.
Come lie with me.
No, no, thank you.
Not the mayor of Casterbridge.
No, think of the star
like Laura,
where you've got Egdon Heath and this great sort of landscape and skyscape and the rest of it.
Return of the Native, try that.
Return of the Native, try that.
This is Thomas Hardy's Return of the Native, which starts with this magnificent description of Egdon Heath in Dorset, which in fact never existed. And he is one of the sort of central characters in The Return of the Native. Well, now a round of clichés from the classics. There are odd lines of poetry from famous poets, which sometimes become expressions in fairly common use. And what I'm going to try and do is to give the lines preceding the one or two lines, which are now in fairly common use, and for 3 marks, teams, I want you to give me the next line or lines, the name of the poet, and the work concerned. So, complete the quotation, give me the name of the poet, and where it comes from. Tillis Power. He recked not of the life he lost, nor prize, but where his rude hut by the Danube lay, there were his young barbarians all at play, there was their Dacian mother, he their sire.
I've never heard of it.
Yes, you have.
Have I?
Mm. Lots of times.
Dacian mother?
Yes, Dacian mother, yes. He was in the wrong place, coming from Dacia. He'd gone to the heart of the empire.
See, the mother's movements were wrong.
No marks allowed. He recked not of the life he lost, nor prize, but where his rude hut by the Danube lay, there was he, were his young barbarians all at play, there was their Dacian mother, he, their sire, butchered to make a Roman holiday. And Dennis Norton, yet why should they know their fate, since sorrow never comes too late, and happiness too swiftly flies, thought would destroy their paradise no more.
Is this and all unconscious of their doom the little victims play?
Yes, quite right, Dennis.
That's Gray, and it's the poem about Eton, distant prospect of Eton.
Yep.
Well, and it's
no more.
No, where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise.
Well done, Dennis.
Yeah.
Okay.
3 marks, Dennis. This is... Thomas Gray's Ode on a Distant Prospect of Eton College, which is as near as most of us get. And Scott James, full many a gem of purest ray serene, the dark unfathomed caves of ocean bear.
Many flowers.
Born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on the desert air.
Poem and poet.
Gray's Elegy.
Yes, three again. They're doing very well. This is Thomas Gray's Elegy, written in a country churchyard at Stoke Poges. Full many a gem of purest ray serene, the dark unfathomed caves of ocean bear. Full many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on desert air. And now Frank Muir, At last he rose and twitched his mantle blue.
Ah, tomorrow to fresh woods and pastures.
Well done.
Milton.
Ben?
Yes, it is.
3 marks to Fag. These are the 2 last lines of Milton's Lycidas. At last he rose and twitched his mantle blue, which is spelled B-L-E-W, tomorrow to fresh woods and pastures new, and it's nearly always misquoted as tomorrow to fresh fields and pastures new. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the 2 teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, Lewis Powell, can you give me the origin of the quotation, "Beware the awful avalanche"?
It's Excelsior, is it?
Excelsior,
yeah. Excelsior by Longfellow.
Mm-hmm. 2 marks it is. Now, Anne Scott James, the origin of your quotation, which was, "Parting is such sweet sorrow."
Well, I think it's from Romeo and Juliet.
Yes, that's all right. 2 marks. And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this particular round, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longest applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so back to Frank Muir and his quotation, "Beware the awful avalanche."
Well, the rain will soon be getting warmer, and we'll be thinking of our summer holidays and booking up for them. And for those of you who are considering going on the continent, here is absolutely everything there is to know about France. The 18th century, France was part of the Grand Tour, when young noblemen went to France to look for paintings by Fragonard and Watteau. And even now, young men go to France hoping to find a little Watteau. But nowadays things have changed enormously. For instance, if you go to France, you don't have to boil everything before you touch it, which is a great comfort if you're going there on your honeymoon. But in France, they do drive on the right. Everybody drives on the right, as distinct from England, where only ladies drive on the right. One of the pleasures of France is to enjoy the special food of the French, like bouillabaisse, which is a sort of soup made by fishermen, and they put in it everything that they catch in their nets, like seaweed and gumboots and old plastic bottles. And if you eat this kind of food, you might get a tummy ache and you go to the doctor. Now, in France, a bismuth tablet, they don't give you so that it progresses in a southerly direction. They insert it so that it travels in a northerly direction. This may come as a bit of a shock to you. It has a very, there's a very good medical reason for this, and that is that if it travels in a northerly direction, the bismuth proceeds through the body at a much slower rate. And if it may seem faintly humiliating at the time, do cling to the fact that there's no bismuth like slow bismuth. The language, they talk a different language in France. Even the young people talk French, even the children, which is very crushing. But you can get by with a few quite simple French phrases. I'll give you a few. You can take notes, by the way. Défense de cracher. You see that around a lot. Défense de cracher. It's please drive carefully. Things like quel dommage, what's the damage, you know, you ask. Phrases you come across, sole bonne femme et un oeuf. Very French phrase there, sole bonne femme. One good woman is enough. There's tact de maison. The girl lives on the premises. If you're taking your car over, use British Railways hovercraft service, which is an absolutely splendid way for taking the car over, taking about 50 minutes. But if you do, and this is a very good tip, don't have the lunch they serve you. It is sausages or fried liver or fried kidneys, none of which are the right things to eat on a choppy crossing of the Channel. So my last hint to you really is eat beforehand or when you get there. But whatever you do, beware the awful hover lunch.
Thank you. And so we go on to Dennis Norden, and if you remember, his quotation was, "Parting is such sweet sorrow."
Going through my finances the other day, I came across some astounding figures with reference to my car. I found out it cost me more money per week to park my car than it does to run it. Now, do you realize how crazy that is? I am paying out more to keep this heavily powered mechanism at rest than I am to put it in motion. The appalling part about that fact is that it served to confirm a theory that I've had for a long time. The moment a man becomes a car owner, every one of his thinking processes warp. You know the saying, all power corrupts. I believe horsepower corrupts absolutely. There is something about the whole business of parking that... Do you remember that night when the whole world was watching the first moon landing and that interminable moment when the spacecraft hovered just above the surface of the moon? Weren't you and all car drivers thinking, go on, go on. It's after 6:30, you could put it anywhere. I think we have come to a stage in human evolution where, you know how birds have the nesting instinct, we now have an inborn parking instinct. You know, with birds, they say that they have this territorial instinct which leads to aggression. Well, parking is the only territorial instinct that's really left to man. And so we have this aggressive instinct. I don't know if you ever had this happen to you. It happened to me the other day. You're driving along a terribly crowded street and suddenly you see this marvelous thing, a free meter. So you drive towards it and you go past it in order to back in. And just as you're getting into reverse, a little mini nips in front. You go ape. I mean, aggression, the zoologists have never seen aggression like in this situation. I jumped out of my car, ran to this mini, and I clawed at the window with my fingernails. I said, "You rotten beast! You can't..." I said, "Step out of that car and I'll pulverize you. I'll smash your face in." Now, nothing else could make me behave like that. In an open street, to a nun. It is so pathetic that you can see now why Shakespeare put it that way. Parking is such street sorrow.
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the story, but all the same, Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden win this entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.